Excuse me, this is the operator. I just want to inform all parties today's call is being recorded. If you should have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. This is Amanda Hendricks, and I'll be hosting the Charm Telecon today. Welcome. This is the November 2007 Charm Telecon, and I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Carl Mitchell of JPL, and he will be talking to us today about the lakes and seas of Titan, observations from Cassini radar. Dr. Mitchell studied physics with space science and technology at Leicester University in the UK, and where he received a bachelor's degree and then got a master's in remote sensing at the University of London, where he first started doing planetary geology, and received his PhD in environmental science from Lancaster University in the UK, studying the physics of explosive volcanic eruptions on the Earth and Mars. And has been a postdoc at JPL, a NASA postdoc, since 2005, after doing a postdoc at Lancaster University. At JPL, he's working with Rosalie Lopez and the Cassini radar team, working on radar data of Titan on volcanoes and lakes. And so today he's going to tell us about some of his latest results. And so with that, I guess we'll have you go ahead and start. Carl.
Okay, thanks, Amanda. I take it you can hear me at the moment, Amanda?
I can hear you.
Okay, I'll assume everyone else can. Okay, I'm going to show you the surface of, well, what is pretty much a new world, but some of you will have looked at it before. I say new world because before Cassini-Huygens arrived, we really had only had tantalizing hints of what Titan's surface might look like, and now our data is already orders of magnitude better than previously. This isn't just the result of my work, this is the result of a very large team of scientists from not only all around America, but from multiple countries, including Italy and France. And so I give due credit to all of my associates on the Cassini radar science team. For decades before Cassini reached the Saturn system, we had this concept of Titan as being a wet world. This was largely based on observations from Voyager, where we saw that there was a methane atmosphere, and telescopic observations. As early as the 1980s, scientists such as Jonathan Lenin were suggesting that Titan had oceans of ethane, based slightly on spectroscopic data, but also on models of how the climate should work. More recently, remote sensing observations seem to rule that out, at least around the equator, which is where they were suggested they might be before. But we still went into the Cassini-Huygens mission thinking that there should be some sort of complex hydrological or methanological system, probably with sanding bodies of liquids and channels. Now, if you could move on to the second slide, please. However, initially, at first, Cassini didn't show us lakes and seas. There was plenty of evidence for precipitation, and a picture of Cassini's hydrocarbon cycle was emerging, involving methane rain, possibly hydrocarbon, nitrile or organic snow, and a whole bunch of complex chemistry. Now, on this side, you'll see some of our early ideas on how this all fit together. You'll see that there's some evidence for cryovolcanic eruption, something we think is a dome, much like the feature on Venus. On the left-hand side there, providing methane to the atmosphere. There are channels up at the top which are carved into the surface, which we think of as being mostly water ice, but possibly many other things there as well. High ridges that have been excavated in some way by erosion, which rainfall may have played a part, and some dune-like forms, or dunes, which were debris that somehow aggregated into small particles, possibly snowed out from the atmosphere, or probably snowed out from the atmosphere. But we didn't actually find any seas, except for these massive sand seas, as Rafferentz puts it. And so there was a question mark still hanging over this idea of where the standing bodies of liquids were, which is hard to rationalize with the climatic models, which all suggested there should be standing bodies unless there was a massive rate of replenishment of methane into the atmosphere, because you need to balance the amount of methane in the atmosphere with the amount of methane on the surface. So a possible explanation was found for this very recently during the Cassini-Huygens mission by Giuseppe Mitri, who was at the time a PhD student at the University of Arizona. and is now working with me, inspired by climatic modelling by Takano and Neubauer, which suggested that low temperatures and their high variabilities in the polar regions could result in lakes of variable size in those polar regions instead of at the equator, which is where people were previously looking. And at that time, we hadn't actually had any images of these polar regions. Evaporation of these lakes would be able to explain the atmospheric, the relative humidity in the atmosphere, as long as they covered at least 0.2% of Titan's surface, so not a huge fraction of the surface compared with, say, seas on the Earth. I was only just becoming aware of this study when we had our first polar flyby. Many of you will have seen the initial paper and press releases showing dark patches on the surface of Titan, and we hope to convince unsuspecting world, perhaps, that these were finally the standing bodies of liquids everyone was talking about. Well, next slide, please. Thanks to massive improvements in image processing technology, we have this splendid image of Titan. Actually, no, this is actually near where I used to live in the UK. Titan's Lake District is somewhat different. This is the Lake District in the northwest of England. If you just flip onto the next image rather than the next slide, it'll replace it with something like what we actually saw the first time. There are more lakes for a start on Titan. There's an incredible density of lakes up here. As we reported in Nature, the T16 near polar flyby alone revealed about 80 radar dark patches. And I use the expression T16. We use this within the team and within Cassini. T standing for Titan, 16 standing for the number of the orbits, the number of the flyby for which we passed it. So this would have been technically our 18th flyby of Titan, but the first two of them were not given numbers. Now, these features we were seeing were by far the darkest surfaces that Cassini radar had ever seen. So radar really wasn't being reflected off and back at the radar instrument. The radar instrument looks sideways, so it needs a certain amount of roughness in order to reflect back, or a slope that's angled into the radar. And clearly this didn't have it. The other thing that can make things dark is if they absorb, and we know from studies in the lab that 2.2 centimeter wavelength radar, which is what we're using for Cassini radar, is absorbed somewhat by methane as well, and it's semi-transparent, I'd say.
Carl, I have a question. Carl?
Oh, yes.
A question from 2 slides ago. When you say that the lakes were...
I don't know if they were predicted, but the climate modeling work of Mitri et al.?
Yeah.
Suggested that low temperatures and their high variabilities... Do you mean high variabilities, temperature variability, like due to seasonal changes?
Yes. Seasonal changes near the poles result in greater temperature changes than seasonal variability at the equator. And that results in changes in rates of precipitation. As the temperature changes, then you get spontaneous precipitation in the atmosphere. So more rainfall there.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Right, let's just see where I am. Okay, next slide, please. Is this going to work for me? It's not going forward. Ah, here we go. What I'm going to do now is take you through the T16 radar swap as I originally saw it. I'd only fairly recently joined the team, so this was all fairly new to me, and then we saw these absolutely wonderful features for the first time. This slide is a little bit animated, so I'm hoping that everyone here has the PowerPoint and the PDF. Apologies to anyone that doesn't, because it really doesn't translate to a PDF. So the first thing, you'll see the entire radar swath near the top of the screen. That's approximately 120 kilometers, so 75 miles or so at the narrowest point from top to bottom. So thousands of kilometers along the swath. And you can already see the little black patches near the center. Well, that near the center was very close to the North Pole. I think it got up to 83 degrees, something like that, at closest approach. So this is going over the pole, the narrowest bit near the North Pole, over the Arctic, I should say. In total, I cataloged about 77 lakes in this, 77 dark patches we were interpreting as lakes. If you click for the next slide, you'll see a zoom-in section, so you'll start to get a better view of these lakes. And then if you click one more time, you should see almost the full resolution there. And you'll see that you've got all these little dark features, mostly irregular, with some of which seem to have rims. The illumination from the radar is from the top of the image. So if you see a bright facing area, that's quite often a slope faced into the radar instrument. A dark slope is faced away. So all of these are depressions, these dark areas here. So in this spot, that's about 130 kilometers, so about 80 miles from top to bottom. So many of these lakes are tens of kilometers across, down to a few kilometers across. You can only see features down to a few hundred meters in size here. So some are circular or near circular, which is interesting because they look somewhat like volcanic calderas on the Earth or something like Crater Lake in Oregon. In fact, similar size as well. And there's one or two that look like they might consist of several circular features, but the fairly big lake just to the left of the center of the screen there looks like it might perhaps consist of multiple circular areas. And several are steep-sided with clear rims. If you go on to the next one, we'll pan along the image as we go through. You see what looks like some sort of large basin. Now, this area here, this dark patch at the bottom of the screen, it's purely due to surface characteristics, so it's clearly darker to the radar than the rest of the scene. However, it's not quite as dark as the lake, so it shares some features with the lake. It could be that this is actually some sort of solid or residue of it having been filled in the past. The jury's still out somewhat on that one. The next part of the scene, you see some of the darkest lakes that we've imaged. These at times go below the ability of the radar instrument to tell any brightness variation on the surface. We've got more noise than signal in some of these. Those are extremely dark and clearly a completely different material from the rest of the surface. The resolution is the highest in this part of the scene, and we start to see channels feeding and connecting lakes. In some places where the lake contents are fairly bright, we also see some channel structures on the floor, which I'm afraid probably won't show very clearly here, but I'm going to show you in more detail in a later slide. That's because, as I said earlier, liquid methane and ethane, and these are the candidate materials for these lakes, are semi-transparent to radar. So it's a bit like looking down on Titan from space. In the same way that you look down at the coastline from satellites on the Earth, you see the sand of a beach going under the water and slowly becoming green and then fading into blue and then black. Okay, the next slide, or the next step, please. This was the best example on this scene of what we think of as perhaps a drained lake. If you go to the bottom left of the image, and it's a bit difficult to make this out, you'll see that there's a fairly large crescent-shaped form. And to the bottom left of that, there's what looks like a depression with a clearly defined, well, with a fairly clearly defined rim around it. That we've interpreted as being what was previously one of these dark things which flowed into the currently dark feature during some sort of drainage event or perhaps slowly evaporated incident, a bit like an evaporite basin on the Earth in desert-like regions. It's morphologically similar in some ways to the other features, which leads us to think it is a lake rather than some other unconnected depression. And the final one of these zoom-ins, you'll see at the bottom of the image, there looks like one of these nested structures I talked about, multiple circular depressions that look a lot like volcanic calderas. In fact, if we saw this structure on any other extraterrestrial planet, we would probably immediately jump to the conclusion that these are volcanic calderas. And there are ideas that you can have something called cryovolcanism on Titan, which is much like volcanism on the Earth, but rather than erupting magma, what you're erupting is water with something like ammonia, something that works as an antifreeze for this cryomagma.
So are these depressions that might not be deep enough for liquid to accumulate in them?
It's possibly the case. It's possible that it's drained or evaporated since then, so that the lake is not filled to its peak as well.
Okay.
So anywhere else we'd say that was probably a volcanic caldera, but there may be alternative interpretations for Titan. Titan is a very complex world, and I use the world word world not lightly. I think of the world as a place with as a planet with a lot of places, or a moon with a lot of places and things that people can relate to, rather than just some sort of dead, dry, sphere-like featureless body. Titan has certainly shown that it's got a lot of variation. It's got most of the geologic processes that work on the Earth. So I very rarely use the word world for a planet. Mars, I think, of somewhat as a world. We've got features like Olympus Mons as well. Certainly Titan's been capturing people's imagination. If you click once more, you'll get a zoom in of that that structure that looks like Nestor Calderas, just to give you a bit more of an idea of what that's like. So that's a few miles across from top to bottom, maybe 10 miles, 15 miles from left to right, something like that. So it's a pretty large structure, perhaps similar to Kilauea volcano in aspect. Okay, on to the next slide. The question we first had to ask ourselves was, are these actually liquid lakes at the moment? We were convinced that these have been lakes. There were channels feeding them, there were shorelines that looked lake-like. We had predictions that there would be lakes in these areas. But that doesn't mean they currently are lakes. I mean, you see a feature that looks like a volcano, it doesn't necessarily mean it's active at the time. And the same is true with lakes. Clearly the fact that they were extremely dark was immediately something that made us think, yeah, these must be liquid. But that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. If you click on the next one, you'll see some more of this morphological evidence that there's channels here, and then straight on to the next one. This third one of these inset images here is an idea of the radar max scatter of the lake. As I said earlier, there was extremely low microwave reflectivity, so extremely the radar is in microwave wavelength. And at times this radar reflectivity goes way below the noise floor, as we call it, of the image. Typically the surface of Titan has a normalized radar cross-section in the order of -10 to maybe -8, -5 decibels. And in places on the rest of the planet, it goes down to, say, -15 decibels. But here you'll see that these lakes go way below anything else we've seen. So that was our first very strong piece of evidence that they were currently active. But we were able to come up with alternatives that could possibly explain this, either a very small or dusty surface, or some sort of wet mud. Something like mud flats could potentially have produced features that were this bright, this dark, I should say. Well, there were more arguments in favor. They were consistent with present-day conditions. There's no reason to think that the lakes wouldn't be liquid filled because this planet is active all of the time. And there's also this dichotomy of these dark lakes and the bright lakes, or the drained-looking lakes. And again, this is a zoom-in of that image I tried to show you earlier with arrows now to highlight where we think this drained lake-like feature was. So there was lots of evidence, but nothing really clinched the deal on this surface scene. No smoking gun. On to the next slide, please. Well, very quickly after this T16 flyby, we had two more, and I'm showing you here in a polar projection. This scene is, let's see if I can work this out, it's a few thousand kilometers across, something like the size of Canada here we're talking about. So from 65 degrees north in 5 degree steps all the way up to the pole. And as we built up this scene, we started to see that the lakes had different characteristics in different areas, and this polar overview shows it quite well. You'll notice that the lakes nearer the pole and towards the bottom of this image scene seem to get bigger. Also in these areas where the lakes are much larger, they tend to be flatter. They don't tend to have a deeply incised rims, except for right at the bottom where you get down to the lower latitudes again. And so there's variability across the scene. So we were starting to get excited as to what would happen as we built up this polar region more and more. Also, right at the bottom right of the scene, you'll notice that there's an unusual shaped lake there, which I'm going to zoom in later, which shows a more rugged coastline, something reminiscent of Lake Powell, perhaps, or the fjords of Sweden. So lots of jagged shorelines. And, yeah, quite a lot of variation. I'm going to
Carl?
Go on to the next. Yes, please.
Carl, before you move on,
I think you said this, but I'd like to ask again, now that I see these three together here. I think mm-hmm. the middle swath is the T16 that you just went through in detail.
That's correct.
And now that I see these three together, that dark area in the middle, a little bit above the middle there,
oh,
really
yeah.
does look different from the other lakes. And what did you say about that one?
Well, I was wondering if it was something that was an old impact crater that was once filled with liquid but is now evaporated and has left some sort of deposit behind. Other people have suggested that it's just filled with hydrocarbon snow because it's a topographic low. We don't really have a firm conclusion on that, but it's definitely darker than most of the surface, but not quite as dark as the lake.
Right. So
we don't really have it as a candidate for a major liquid body.
But it could be an impact crater that filled in.
It could well be, yeah.
Are there other impact craters in here that could have filled in?
Well, we don't see many impact craters on the surface of Titan. It's quite interesting. It suggests that the surface of Titan is quite young.
Right.
In these scenes, there is nothing that I would say unambiguously is an impact crater, including this basin. It may well be something else.
Right.
Carl?
Yep.
I'm a little lost. What slide number are you on?
Slide number six.
Six?
Six, yes.
Okay, thanks.
Also, for everybody online, do be sure that you're following along in PowerPoint in slideshow mode, and that way you can...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's important. It has to be in the slideshow mode, because quite a lot of the individual slides have inputs come in and change.
Carl, could you also describe the title of each slide for those of us who printed it out and don't have any page numbers?
Okay, the title of this slide number six is Flybys, page number six. And I'm just about to go on to post T16, page number 7. T19, which was the third North Polar flyby, the second one didn't really show us all that much other than how far south some of these lakes were. It revealed this new morphology, and you'll see an image at the top right of this slide, hopefully, if you're on the PowerPoint. Showing larger lakes with rugged coastlines, as I said, like Lake Powell or the Scandinavian fjords. And we're seeing growing evidence that we're seeing through these liquids. As I said earlier, methane is transparent. And if you right-click on your PowerPoint and go backwards and forwards, you'll be able to see the contrast changing on this image. And what hopefully you'll see is that there's a channel that leads in from the bottom and that seems to wind its way through some of this lake material. So again, we're probably seeing through at least several meters, but unfortunately the degree of transparency of liquid methane and ethane isn't actually very well known. We're trying to get to it with lab measurements. I've got a colleague in France, who is Philippe Payou, his name is, who is doing various lab measurements in order to understand how far deep you might be able to see through these bodies with radar. But we know that it must be at least the order of a meter down to maybe 100 meters that you can potentially see through. So if you see a subsurface structure on the bottom of the lake, assuming that they're liquid filled, which is a very strong case now, then you're probably seeing down to the depth of a few to maybe 100 or so meters. Okay, next image. This is zoomed out a little bit and back from that image, and so right at the top you see that channel that led into that lake, and basically what we've got here is a very long river valley, many hundreds of kilometers, so maybe a few hundred miles long, leading from a triangular region, I hope you can see that, about two-thirds up on the left, a depression that some of us have interpreted as a flyer, so another drained lake structure, all the way into that liquid body. And you'll also see a lot of these features here that we've also interpreted as empty lakes or drained lakes all the way through the rest of this scene. In certain areas, they seem to cluster together, and they're much more apparent than on that original T16 flyby. Now, by the time we've got to this T19, this is 100 kilometers across this strip, by the way, I should have said that earlier. By the time we got to this T19 flyby, we'd actually seen about 0.2% of the surface of Titan was covered with these dark patches. Now, you may remember from earlier I mentioned that there was a study that said there had to be 0.2% of the surface covered with lakes in order to explain the methane humidity in the atmosphere. And so we'd hit that critical level whereby it was more consistent, again, with this climatic modeling.
Carl, is that 0.2 to 2% above a particular latitude then?
No, you just needed 0.2 to 2% on the entire planet, and that's at least 0.2 to 2%, so 10% would be okay, but that was the bottom end.
Even though there's more expected in the polar regions?
Yes.
Okay.
So that's covering the entire planet. So by this time, we'd observed a fair fraction of the surface of the planet, and we're starting to get to that 0.2% level.
Oh, I've got a couple of questions. This is Ken in North Carolina. First off, the karst you mentioned on slide, I think it was 5, about karst topography.
Yeah.
What is the surface at this point made of? Is it mostly water ice? I mean, what are we talking about here?
I'm actually going to go into that a bit later, so I'm going to defer most of that question. The karst interpretation is something that came up as an alternative to the cryovolcanic interpretation on some of these depressions. And I will talk about that in more detail, but the surface is primarily water ice. The crust is primarily water ice, but there's a lot of evidence that something like solid hydrocarbons or nitriles, organics, flows out onto the surface, perhaps reprocesses in some way, and so that's somewhat more soluble than water ice. Water ice under Titan conditions is not very soluble on liquid methane. I mean, it just would not dissolve, at least not over anything other than billions of years to any noticeable degree.
And the second question I have has to do with the physical properties of methane itself.
Yes.
When it freezes, would it float or sink on its liquid counterpart?
Okay. Liquid methane, if it were to freeze, would sink. However, Titan's surface temperature, which is of the order of 95 Kelvin or about 1.5 bars, we don't think it actually ever goes below the liquidus of liquid methane, or it goes to about the liquidus of methane. And so we really don't expect it to freeze. The other thing is that when we've got methane on the surface, the chances are there's a component of ethane and perhaps a component of dissolved nitrogen, which would also deflate the liquid further. And so we really don't think it would freeze under any circumstances unless you've got some sort of spurious local conditions.
And have you got a feel for how tall some of these features are? What's the range of height and depth here as we're looking?
Yes. I can't give you any specific examples on any of these images because we really don't have very accurately. But we do have some boundary, and the variations on a reasonably local scale are of the order of a few kilometers. So this is suppressed relative to at least mountainous areas on the Earth. And some of these depressions here, they're most likely of the order of hundreds of meters to a few kilometers maximum, but most likely just hundreds of meters in depth for the really clear depressions. Okay, so I suppose one more click. The question is anyone getting convinced by this evidence, or is anyone not convinced by this evidence that these are liquids? This is something I've been asking in lots of talks before, because really you have to convince a fair amount of the community that these are liquids before you can go on and just assume that they're liquids and use that in your models. Otherwise, future models that rely on them being liquids are difficult to justify in many ways. But by this stage, we were fairly convinced, and we were 99.9% sure that these were liquids. We hadn't completely eliminated the possibility that a lot of them weren't liquids at the moment, but we were getting there. Okay, next slide, and this is a big leap forward now. This is a slide called One Year at Titan's Arctic, slide number 8, and it's a color mosaic of the North Pole, or the North Polar region of Titan, from 65 to 90 degrees north. The color is synthetic. We've basically colorized the lakes in blue, but we've done it based on the brightness. And so it's a fairly good indicator of where we think the lake materials are. Clearly, there's a lot of room for error here. It's a simple threshold. But it is pretty striking how well dark areas match up to lake-like morphologies. So this is 2,250 kilometers wide, consists of 9 synthetic aperture radar images in 2 different modes, and we've imaged here almost 70% of this North Polar region. There will be little future coverage from now on, at least for the next year or so, during the primary and extended missions. And so this is it for quite a long time. This is state of the art. And you'll notice the really striking thing about these new scenes that we've added is the extreme scale of these lakes. This, if you go into the top right quadrangle, you'll notice a very large near-circular lake. It's actually 100,000 square kilometers in area, imaged area. That is larger than anything we call a lake on the Earth, as I understand it. Most things that are approaching that in size or beyond that in size we call inland seas. So we nicknamed this the Black Sea. It will have an official name at some point in the near future. I think that everyone, the community now, has settled on the expression seas for these large bodies. They're certainly somewhat different in morphology, so distinct from the lake. And they are just unmatched on the surface of any other planet except the Earth, obviously. One of the other teams, the ISS team, imaging system site, something like that. I'm terrible with acronyms sometimes. Caught a glimpse of this dark sea on the bottom right quadrangle here that we've got a couple of images showing part of. That seems to extend somewhere further south than this this pole region, according to their image data, which is much lower resolution. It's fuzzy, but you get this this image of a big black blob down there. I'm afraid I haven't got something of this, but you can look it up on the JPL Photo Journal website if you are so inclined. That's almost certainly much larger than 100,000 square kilometers. So we're talking about something that, again, is unprecedented on any planet other than the Earth.
Carl, do you...
Yes?
It looks to me like all of the large seas are over in, you know, kind of one longitude range.
Yeah.
On the other side, it's mostly the small lakes. Is that real, do you think, or anything...
I do think that's real. I said earlier that the lakes were clustered. And I'm wondering if it's something like Minnesota, the Great Lakes, that sort of thing. You know, if, for those of you that have been to those parts of America, you've got these massive lakes, and quite a lot of the time, fairly near the edges, you've got these areas of karst-like terrain. So terrain that has been chemically dissolved and weathered away. So perhaps in the topographic, on the slightly topographic lower regions, you've got these broad Great Lakes or seas, and then in the topographically higher areas, just around the shores, you've got quite a lot of drainage, but the formation of these very small lakes. Certainly, there does seem we've only got the North Pole. We're waiting for South Pole data, and I'll show you our first glimpse of South Pole later. But from this one scene, which is admittedly only one data point, there does seem to be a dichotomy from one hemisphere to the other of these large sea-like features and these small clustered lakes. Okay, skip on to the next slide, please. The second of these 1 year at Titan's Arctic. This is just a glimpse of some of our preliminary mapping efforts. Perhaps this highlights more the variation in surface feature types around here. The yellow ones on this scene, the yellow lakes, as we classify them, are the drained features. The green lakes are small, irregular, normally with a slight rim. There's a few dotted little blue ones in there, which are circular, look something like a volcanic caldera, and we can't eliminate the possibility that some of these depressions do are volcanic calderas, but to have this entire region, all of those green ones being volcanic calderas, is starting to look by this stage pretty unlikely. I think that we had to start thinking of alternative hypotheses, and when it comes to clusters, major clusters of dozens, hundreds of lakes, thermocarst, which is melted areas of permafrost on the Earth, or karst, which is dissolved regions of normally limestone or other water-soluble materials on the Earth, are the real analogs, the main candidates for some process that could explain these features. So on to the next slide. Now, the next slide is a movie. I'm hoping that those of you that have got the PowerPoint will have the version that's got the embedded movie and is viewable. If it's not, there's a web link on the download site. Hopefully, for those of you that couldn't view that, will have downloaded the movie as well.
I went out to the movie link, and both the large format and small format, it says that page is unavailable.
That page is unavailable? Oh.
Yeah, that's the error I get.
I had no trouble downloading it earlier, but, oh dear.
Did other people have problems downloading it?
Amanda, this is Jane. I went onto the website, and for people who, I couldn't get it off the Charm page, but if you go to the to the Cassini website and go to latest videos, you can get it there. So unfortunately, it doesn't. It seems to. I wasn't able to do it on the PowerPoint or from the Charm link. But
okay. Well, hang on. Let's So if you go to saturn.jpl.nasa.gov,
Let me find it here.
Is that what you mean, Jane? And then you can go to multimedia.
Yep.
Okay.
So I go to Cassini, and then I go to multimedia.
Well, it sounds like some of you have not managed to download this. So what I'm going to suggest is that we leave this video to the end, and that those of you that have been unable to download it so far will have a bit more time to try to get to it.
Okay. But in the meantime...
Oh, wait, excuse me. Before you do that, tell us what the name of it is on this videos page.
That's what we're doing. We're getting there.
It's called Titan's North Polar Region.
So it's on the top row on the
top
right.
Row, rightmost of multimedia videos, latest videos. And if anybody needs the link, we'll be happy to email it to you, to all the various lists.
Could you send out the link to the lists now so that anyone have to ask?
I can send it out,
That would be great. So hopefully everyone will be able to download that by the end. So if we can skip on to slide... in number 11, present-day liquids, and sorry for all these pauses here. Obviously, there's a lot of animations in there, so it's not quite as simple as a basic PowerPoint. So I've been talking about the case for liquids. Whenever I present this to an audience, I get a different reaction. Sometimes they start to become immediately convinced that these are liquids. Other times, they're more skeptical. So we decided that we had to make a stronger case, a watertight case, if you will. And so we brought together all the data that we could and every argument that we could in order to make a stronger case as possible. Now, again, it's very difficult to come up with a deductive smoking gum argument in favor. Nearly every individual component of the argument has a possible flaw. However, if we can build up enough arguments that make the alternative seem less and less realistic, perhaps we can come up with a case that everyone's happy with. If any of you have read the Nature paper, I've got no idea if any of you did. Again, it's not essential. We suggested that there was one possibility, which was a solid or gooey or potentially powdery organic hydrocarbon or nitrile residue. Next image, please. There were various lines of evidence that we used to suggest it wasn't. In particular, these drained features here. So this sub-image should hopefully have popped into your screen, labeled D at the top right, which we've interpreted as flares or empty lakes. There was the argument about the low microwave reflectivity. And more recently, with some of these images, we've been able to see features along the floor that vary in darkness. And we came up with a little thought experiment, which was that if you saw a channel leading into a lake, and then you saw that channel existed on the lake floor bottom and continued through the lake, if that lake was liquid-filled, it should get darker. The channel floor under the surface of the lake should get darker if it really is an old channel that the lake is now filled beyond that level. This is because you should be looking through progressively more and more liquids, because that lake would have had to have, that channel would have had to have gone downhill, and so when the lake rose above it, it was looking through more and more depth of liquids. And so we measured the radar brightness along this channel here, which is the third inset, I think, on this present-day liquid slide. And it's reversed, so from right to left of the boxes on the top of the slide, it's from left to right on the graph. And you will see that the normalized radar cross-section did indeed reduce as you went down further and further along these channels into the lake. So that in itself was, again, very consistent with the liquids idea. Perhaps you could come up with an argument that a solid would change in grain size distribution or something like that and progressively get darker and darker as you went into the body of the lake. But again, another fairly strong piece of evidence in favor. Okay, next slide, please. Another exercise that we went through was to look at some lakes from different angles. And again, I've got a colleague in France who specializes in this sort of multi-look modeling. And basically, by looking at something from different angles, you get more of an idea about how that something interacts with the incoming radiation, the incoming light. And he basically set up several different scenarios, let's call them, of what the liquids, what the lake could consist of, whether it was liquids, whether it was solids, whether it was some sort of grainy material, and used his model, put these into his model as a hypothesis test for what these might be. So he ran the model several times with different combinations of material, different depths of lakes, that sort of thing, in order to try to account for the observations. Now, mostly everything was consistent with standing bodies of liquid. Notice that there's time interval between these observations. For nearly every observation that we made of lakes, there was no evidence of any kind of change in the content either. So, by and large, again, consistent with liquid lakes, potentially consistent with solids, but they would have to be solids of varying volume, varying scattering properties to the radar, unusually varying. Again, something that would be quite difficult to account for, changes in grain size distribution or gravelly on the surface. One lake in particular that we tend to refer to rather dryly as Lake 20, I believe it's been put forward for an official name, but this one shown here in this multi-look modeling slide, number 12. This showed some brightening in the bottom left hand, bottom left of the lake as you observe it from here. And my colleague Philippe ran his model for this lake and focused on it in particular, and found that there were three possible explanations that fit in with the observations. One is that this was indeed a liquid-filled lake, and that this liquid-filled lake, the level changed by at least 3 meters. And so what you've got is drainage from the first pass to the second pass. That's fine, but unfortunately there are, as ever with this sort of modeling, alternative explanations. Another is that this is just a simple lake, but with a slope in the lake bed, and due to the different angles that we're observing this lake from, the first of these is 31 degrees from horizontal. The second is 16 degrees from horizontal. So you're looking at a different grazing, different observation angles. That it's simply a trick of the light, as it would be with optical imagery, and that you're seeing through different levels of the liquid.
Carl?
Actually, yes.
Since we're in presentation mode, the slide numbers don't show up on the screen, so it would be helpful if you'd tell us what the title of the particular, because you got these slides with different images that pop up, and sometimes it doesn't match what you're saying.
Okay, the slide name is multi-look modeling.
Okay, thanks.
So, yes, the second potential explanation is that this was a liquid with a slope in the lake bed. And thirdly, that we could still just about explain this using a solid surface. It was much more difficult, but we had to have a very, very specific configuration of the material that's properties changed spatially over the surface. But again, it was still plausible. We can't actually come up with any real material that could fit this, but we still thought we should address that as a possibility. Again, still no smoking gun, but now I think that the case has got to a level at which everyone I speak to, at least in the community, is happy with this interpretation that these are liquids. We're a very skeptical community sometimes, so it takes a lot of work to get these ideas through. Okay, the next slide is called Origin of Depressions 1. I mentioned earlier that we had this idea that some of these features might be cryovolcanic, and certainly, morphologically, some of these circular depressions, in particular the nested ones, but many of the lakes still do look a lot like volcanic calderas, and I'm thinking Kilauea and Crater Lake as being perhaps the two most striking examples in North America. The problem is that they're difficult to account for, considering the number of lakes and the fact that most of the lakes are not this kind of very neat, steep, nested structures. And so if only a few of them are cryovolcanic features, well, why would any of them be cryovolcanic features? That was the big question that came up. Time step, please. This is Crater Lake, Oregon again. This is the same sort of size as the previous side image. It shows how there are some striking similarities. Again, I'm afraid I didn't manage to find a radar images of Crater Lake, Oregon, but you can probably make out the similarities there. And the next time step is an example of some lakes that we really don't think are easily explained as cryovolcanic calderas. They're fairly large structures. They may have circular aspects, but there's islands connecting bits, channels leading into them. Volcanic calderas, normally you don't get channels leading into them unless they're particularly unusual ones. But it would be difficult to account for the huge abundance of these lakes at the North Pole. You'd need some, if they were all calderas of some sort, you'd need some incredible hot spot under the North Polar Cap. We haven't really come up with an explanation as to why this might happen for Titan. There are ideas as to why it's happened on one hemisphere, at least, for Enceladus. But no one's come up with a decent geophysical explanation for large amounts of volcanism on Titan at the North Pole. Next slide, Origins of Depressions 2. So instead we've been looking at this karst analog. The karst is a geological features formed by the chemical dissolution of soluble substrates, so normally limestone or something like that on the Earth. They are generally formed... the advantage of this process is that you don't need a second geologic process to form them. The existence of the lakes themselves explains the depressions. All you need is standing bodies of liquid in any old depression for any period of time, and they will start dissolving into the substrate. The problem is that, at least for most of the time, we've been thinking of this substrate as being water ice, and if you put liquid methane on water ice at these temperatures, you don't get dissolution. However, the atmospheric models also seem to suggest that other stuff knows out of the surface. Many of these products would be something that people in the petroleum industry would be quite familiar with. Benzene being one of them, acetylene. Things are quite often highly flammable on the Earth. They form fairly inert solids on Titan, not as inert as water ice, but behave somewhat like basaltic rock on the Earth. But they are soluble. At least to some extent or other. Sometimes sticky, sometimes not. And they could certainly, at least some of them, explain dissolution chemistry. So maybe we're in a situation where this entire polar region, where this entire polar region is covered in some layer of snow. Snow's the right term. I think it's as good as any. Again, there's analogs with the Arctic and the Antarctic on the Earth. So this idea was something that slowly was sprung on us. A few colleagues suggested it to begin with, and then we went with it. And the great thing is that it can explain almost every feature in this North Polar region. Nothing we have is inconsistent with karst. There are some problems. Karst lakes are generally smaller on the Earth, much smaller. Of course, there could be lots and lots of much smaller karst lakes on this image, we're seeing down to at best a few hundreds of meters resolution. There may be millions of these little things down in tens of meters resolution. We don't know for sure until we can get a lander there or a separate spacecraft. But certainly these would be large for cast legs on the Earth. If you could do the next time step, please. Why is it not working for me? And the next time step after that, this is an example of thermocast in Canada, I believe. Thermocast's a bit like cast. The lake basically melts down into the substrate, and it can form very caldera-like features at times. We've been looking at thermocast largely because the scale of thermocast on the Earth is often quite large. It's often more comparable with these features on Titan. Why we would get thermocast scale features rather than cast scale features is a matter of some debate. Potentially, you've got much longer time scales involved with these processes on Titan. You don't have quite the biological activity that you do on the Earth. Erosion rates are probably much lower, and so these features may have a lot longer to form, and so potentially they could get a lot larger. And this final slide here shows some of large. Yes.
Can you define what you mean by thermocast?
Thermocast is what happens when you've got a body of liquid on the surface of the Earth, specifically, and incoming solar radiation. And that incoming solar radiation heats up the liquid to such an extent at which the body of liquid itself melts the substrate. So a way you have this on the Earth is quite common in Alaska and Canada, where you've got permafrost regions. So you've got soil that's saturated with water ice. And so you get a liquid raining out onto the surface, and rather than immediately freezing, because it's got some component that it can be heated by the sun, it stays warmer than the surrounding materials and then starts to melt into the substrate. They're quite unusual features. They're extremely well drained at times, and sometimes they can just vanish almost overnight. You can get lakes that are many hundreds of kilometers, hundreds of meters across, that for some reason something just pops in them. And you get a little whirlpool forming, and then they drain out somewhere else, normally out to sea is the concept. These things are generally in coastal areas. But if you've got access to Google Maps at some point, look at the west coast of Alaska, you'll see loads of these. Now, we don't think this can happen on Titan. There's just not enough solar radiation. And even if there was enough solar radiation, it probably mostly couldn't get through the atmosphere. But cast is a much more realistic process because we do have something that would allow this dissolution chemistry. But morphologically speaking, these things are actually very similar in appearance to this thermocast in Alaska. So we've been looking at quite a lot of these Google Maps and Google Earth images of Alaska recently, and maybe at some point we'll get a field trip. So the last of the images on the Origins of Depression 2 slide is Florida, Central Florida, which shows some fairly large cast lakes. I said in general they're much smaller than the ones on Titan. The largest of these ones that you see here in Florida are actually comparable with some of the fairly small ones on Titan. And you'll see that some of them are very circular. There's one slightly above right center of the image that is very circular and could easily be mistaken as a volcanic caldera if you looked, if you just decided to interpret it on its own. The other thing that's quite striking about this image is that you'll see there's what looks like a ridge going from top to bottom of the image. And to the west of that ridge, the lakes in general seem to be smaller than the lakes to the right of that image. Well, that's because they're different geological surface units that have slightly different dissolution properties. And so perhaps this is an explanation for the clustering of the different features that we're seeing on Titan, in that it's just surface geology variations modulate the appearance of the lakes as they dissolve into the substrate. Next slide, please, called Consequences of Cast. So as I said earlier, it requires a methane-soluble substrate to explain this. And we have to speculate that chemistry. We have, we do have spectroscopic instruments in orbit around Titan. Those spectroscopic instruments are very good, but unfortunately, Titan's atmosphere is very opaque, and so we really don't get accurate spectra of surface features. Certainly not accurate enough in order to determine what the chemical composition might be, which is what you can normally get for planets with no atmosphere. And so we need to use a combination of models and inference in order to get as educated a guess of what the surface materials might be. And also you need to observe what the chemistry is in the atmosphere. And we've certainly seen chemicals like benzene in the atmosphere. Here's a list of substances that were once at least thought to be, this was a long time ago, this paper was put together in 1987, this was sourced from, once thought to be materials that could exist dissolved in the oceans of Titan. I don't expect you to go through the numbers all that much, except to have a look at the column that says dissolved. And the figure in parentheses here under dissolved is parts per million. And anything that can be dissolved in a liquid methane or ethane body of to the extent of maybe 10 parts per million or greater is something that may well be an explanation for cast-like properties of the surface. So clearly, water is well below 1, so it's not even on this chart. But certainly a zeppelin is plausible, and we could have large amounts of zeppelin on the surface of Titan. On the far right column, someone once suggested you could have as much as 86 meters worth of a zeppelin globally if it didn't react with anything. Well, it probably does react with other materials, but certainly that could be an explanation. There are others like benzene, propane, again, things that people in the oil industry will be very familiar with that would also dissolve down to these levels. Could also produce 100-meter scale depressions with standing bodies of liquids for maybe tens, hundreds, and thousands of years. So we have some candidates. Without a future mission, we'll probably be unlikely to resolve those. We really need a lander that lands somewhere up near the poles or some sort of balloon mission in order to really get at these properties of the surface. If this is, therefore, cast, and if the depths of these lakes, which we have in places measured to a few hundred meters, is indicative of the thickness of a non-waterized soluble layer, then we actually have an extensively thick polar cap. Now, it isn't like the polar cap on the Earth, but it's not something that will phase change into liquid and melt. The liquids and the solids in polar regions are actually quite different chemistries. But nonetheless, it's something that is, a striking analogue with the Earth. If there is such a polar cap, it will have a poor thermal conductivity compared with water and ice. And possibly you get some sort of build-up of heating, leading to more active subsurface chemistry. A colleague of mine, Jeff Cargill, used the word goons to explain some of these materials that could become fairly mobile as liquids and solids. And so you could have a huge amount of things going on here, and this is a vast variety of speculation that can go on here. But the point is that we really cannot know anything like what the real variety would be. It's likely that the complexity is well beyond our ability to be able to grasp from limited scientific studies. This is one of the reasons that we're hoping sometime in the future that we may well be able to go back to Titan and study it in more detail. The complexity is really only comparable with processes on the Earth. No other planet has quite this active and near-surface chemistry. Okay, next slide, please. Drainage, this one's called. I've shown bits of this slide before, and I mentioned that cast is associated with a well-drained surface. On the Earth, when you find cast, you also tend to find these things called sinkholes, which are lake-like, and you also find caves. Now, earlier we were talking about how you had regions with small lakes, regions with large lakes. There's no real evidence of surface interconnectivity, so no channels linking the small lake region with the large lake region. And so we'd expect that if you had equal rainfall throughout the entire polar region, there would have to be transport from one to the other. So this must be in the subsurface. again, supporting evidence that this is some sort of task-like process. Again, this is the reshown the image here where you can see through the liquids. Let's skip that and go on to the third image on this one, which is a tall, long, thin image. Again, this is showing more evidence of drainage here. There are some of these river-like features. Near the top here, there's a river connecting to an outlet into a sea-like area. And also these drained lakes around here. This is all very familiar to those people that have studied karst on the Earth. And we never really thought that we'd be consulting people that studied terrestrial karst. This is something that no one really predicted at the time. It was a nice surprise, and now chatting with terrestrial scientists and bringing in other areas of the scientific community, which is fun to be able to do for a planetary scientist. All too often the surface of the planet's lots and lots of impact craters and volcanoes, and it's good to have some sort of cross-fertilization with different academic communities. So subsurface flow on quite a large scale seems inevitable, and this is something we're only getting into modeling now, and we hope that we'll be able to come up with ideas about what sort of rates of flow are plausible, and maybe the existence of these large lakes, we can infer something about the rates of flow and then infer something about what the subsurface materials might be. But again, studies for the future. I mentioned earlier that we'd had a bit of a look at the South Pole, so let's go on to this next slide. There's not many left now. We predicted after seeing a few flybys of the North Pole that there would be South Polar lakes. ISS, the imaging instrument, had actually observed a dark blob near the South Pole, which is the initial suggestion that there might be a lake on site from Cassini data was from ISS, this lake that they named Ontario Lacus. And we now feel fairly comfortable to support her interpretation. Again, this was a dark blob against a pale background, so at the time it was fairly speculative. But it turns out to have most likely been right. So this slide here, number 18, South Pole predictions and first observations, shows our first flyby of the southern polar regions. And we've put a little inset in here showing using the same sort of color scale as we use in the North Pole. And you'll see that there are a few tiny little lakes. Again, we didn't get too close to the pole with this one. I think it got up to about 72 degrees north. So we didn't expect many lakes on this flyby, and we found just a few. So,
Is Ontario Lacus on here?
No, it's not. We're going to image that at some point in the future. I just can't remember when. It's within the next year, I believe.
Where would it be located on this map if it would be there? This is Ken from New Jersey.
I really can't tell you off the top of my head. I'm sorry about that. It's somewhere around 75 degrees south, but I can't remember the longitude.
The longitude is about 180
west. 180
west. Yeah, 180,
okay.
190.
Okay, so there you go. It's near the bottom left of this image.
And what is the size of these particular lakes compared to Ontario Lacus? Are they much smaller?
Much smaller. Ontario Lacus is smaller than the large sea-like bodies that we find in the northern hemisphere, but larger than most of the lakes. So I'll be interested to see what the morphology is like, whether it's more consistent with the lakes or the seas, or whether it's some sort of hybrid when we actually see Ontario Lacus finally. The other thing is that you're 180 degrees out in terms of season in the southern hemisphere. So when we see here, there may well be differences in how filled the lakes are compared with the northern hemisphere. Some people suggested they may be more filled. Some people suggested they may be less filled. You can't really get that much from this first flyby. But if we map out the southern hemisphere and find that there are differences in the northern hemisphere, that will hopefully tell us something more about the climate.
Well, this is summer, I guess, right? Because in the north, it's winter right now, right?
In the north, I think it's approaching spring, so it's the end of the summer. Maybe someone else on the telecom can confirm that, but we're hoping that Cassini will last long enough to get us well into the spring. And so there's some chance that we may well see any changes due to seasonality, maybe just at the North Pole. But to begin with, contrast with the South Pole will probably tell us quite a bit more.
So I guess my question is basically, what's the temperature difference between the North and the South Pole right now?
It's not all that great. It's of the order of 1 Celsius or so, I believe.
That's all?
Maybe 2.
So
yeah, well, it's like the whole planet's blanketed, so it remains fairly constant. It's kind of like a tropical climate in some ways, which seems counterintuitive for somewhere that's so cold. But it's got a very thick atmosphere. It's like having a major greenhouse effect going on. So the temperature variability isn't that great. However, over a daily time period, you get some variability as well. I think that I probably suggest, say, 4 or 5 Kelvin might be the temperature extremes at the poles. Either way, so well within the 19 in Kelvin. So pretty cold. But those slight changes can make quite a big difference climatically on induced rainfall. So.
But it's not like it's dramatically colder and that there would be a lake now and as opposed to when it got warmer and it would all evaporate.
Well, we don't know that for sure. The lakes are probably constantly evaporating to some extent, just like water is on the Earth. They need to be replenished by rainfall. And so if you've got a season in which rainfall doesn't occur as much, just due to a tiny difference in the temperature variability, then yes, you would expect to see the lakes going down. Also, if you've got subsurface drainage, the rate of which you would need to replenish them would have to be higher. So there's a fair chance we will see seasonal variability, assuming we have enough observations of the life of the mission. But again, these are still early days, even though it's been going since imaging since 1994. Not 1994, 2004.
And there are more passes of the South Pole coming up, is that right?
Yeah, this was just our first one. We're not going to have as many as the North Pole. In the extended mission, I think we've got 3. So
in the north or south, Carl?
In the south.
I'm asking about the south.
Yeah. Most ones in the south, and then only one more in the north late in extended mission.
Yeah, and of course we're hoping for Cassini to go on indefinitely, effectively. I mean,
with the going on indefinitely, actually, I spoke with Jonathan Lenin about this. You don't have enough fuel, right? Beyond about 7 years?
You can conserve fuel by using a slightly more conservative campaign if necessary. It depends on the pros and cons. I know the imaging instruments can suffer by being in space for too long because you've got more net cosmic radiation bombardment and therefore something's more likely to go wrong. The radar doesn't suffer too much from that. But I think most people want the mission to last for a very long time because seasonal variability would be an amazing thing to find, and there are other potential benefits of keeping it going for as long as possible. But I've heard people suggest 2012 or even longer as how long the spacecraft could last for. Someone once suggested a scenario of 2015, I believe. I don't know whether this is going to be the strategy that we go for in the end. It's all very much you have to respond to circumstances, but we're optimistic that we'll get a lot more images out of it.
Thank you.
Okay, next slide. So, I've come back to this slide that we showed at the beginning, which was an attempt to show all the evidence for different vegetation-like processes and Titan's hydrocarbon cycle. And so we've come full circle to a certain extent. Now we're trying to understand the relative contributions of all these different processes and see how they all mesh together. This is very much analogous to the understanding of the water cycle on the Earth that's often shown in science lessons throughout schools, but is incredibly important for life on the Earth, and is also important for how Titan as a body works. If we can understand the components of this hydrocarbon cycle on Titan, we're very much understanding how the planet lives and breathes. And so these standing bodies of liquid fill an important role in this process. They balance the amount of methane in the atmosphere. If the methane in the atmosphere goes down, you get a higher rate of evaporation of these liquids. If the methane in the atmosphere goes up, you get a lower rate of evaporation and you get precipitation. And so they're critical to this whole system. The inputs to the system, the cryovolcanism, is something we still don't really understand all that well. We've seen features that are indicative of cryovolcanic activity, and we've got observations planned that will test some future ideas. We certainly haven't seen anything that suggests that there is cryovolcanism ongoing at the moment, although potentially it could be. And So we're very much trying to understand in the future, trying to see if we can come up with anything that suggests that there's something going on and understand the nature of that cryovolcanic process. And we're going to be doing some work on that at JPL as well. That's the other half of my research. But understanding this all as a living, breathing system, much like we try to understand how the Earth works, is very much a goal of scientists over the next few years, now that we've managed to get some idea of the surface variability of Titan. Okay, on to the next slide. In order to get a handle on that, we're going to have to understand the physical properties and the chemical properties of all of these materials. Most of the non-water ice components that could be on Titan are well understood on the Earth, under Earth-like conditions, but at these low temperatures that we observe on Titan, there's been very little lab work done. And so JPL has started up a new cryo-ices lab. Other groups around the country have, and abroad as well, particularly my colleague in France, have been coming up with various experiments to understand not only how these various materials interact, so how methane dissolves various solids, for instance, but also how they interact with the radiation that's relevant to the Cassini instruments, so what these different things look like on radar. Some of this obviously has been done before the mission, but it's amazing how many things come up mid-mission that we thought, wow, why didn't we ever ask that question before? And so a lot of the work that's going on in Cassini now, supporting Cassini, is actually somewhat behind the scenes in the lab, and we've got some absolutely great people doing various experiments. As I said, at JPL we've got this cryo-ices material. We're synthesizing ices of different sorts, and we're using ice in the very general sense. Now, this is a solid that's a liquid or a gas under conditions on the Earth. So various of these hydrocarbons are called ices. We're measuring their mechanical properties, how they respond to strain. Things that might be in a liquid state, we're measuring some of their viscous properties, how they flow. We're looking at how methane would interact with different solids. If you put a drop on the surface, what would it do? This isn't always something that's obvious and can't always be modeled very easily until we've done some basic experiments. So some of these things are, a lot of these things are ongoing at the moment, and I'm sure lots of people will be very happy to talk about these in depth, but I'm not going to say much more about this. Next slide is conclusions. I won't spend too much time on this. I'm getting near the end now. Cassini radar has revealed a world that has an incredibly rich landscape. It's got lakes, it's got things that look like volcanoes, and a lot of these are active today, which makes it quite unique in the solar system. It's more planet-like than many of the planets, even though it's just a moon or Saturn. It's a big moon and there's a lot going on. No other planet do we seem to have as well-developed an environmental system, as complex interaction as we have on Titan, other than the Earth. And so we're considering Titan to be a remarkable place for studying processes as a whole, without just thinking of them as purely Earth-terrestrial processes. We get a glimpse of how lakes behave with different materials under different conditions, and whether the rules that apply to the Earth also apply to other planets. We think that these lakes, which is the subject of this talk, are liquids, probably methane, ethane, and lesser quantities of dissolved nitrogen. We cannot say that 100% for sure, but every piece of evidence, every little test we come up with, supports this idea that they are liquids. First time we found standing bodies of liquids on any other than volcanic liquids. Io is an exception, and Triton as well, volcanic liquid, on any body other than the Earth. So this is a major discovery. One thing we've started to do more recently is to try to estimate the depth of some of these lakes, because the lakes are transparent, we can get some indication. We may also be able to get some indication of the depth in stereo. There are various techniques trying to estimate the surface of the solids, but the liquids are a bit more tricky. So hopefully we'll be able to get a very good indication of the total lake content of Titan. And I know that Ralph Lorenz has done some preliminary estimates of this. There's a lot more liquid methane on Titan, just on the surface of what we've been able to observe, than there are terrestrial oil reserves, for instance, to give some idea of scale. But there's so much more work to be done, and so many unknowns, so we're hoping at some point in the future that we may well be able to go back to Titan. I think that's it, apart from the movie. I hope that all of you have been able to download the movie by now. If not, well, we'll send you the links, and maybe you can look at it another time. So if you could go to the movie, those of you that have access to it, on this PowerPoint slide I'm looking at, slide number 10, and to start it up, you will have to click on it. So if you start it up now, I'll take you through it. Hold on a second, I'm going to have to ask you to pause it there. For some reason, it's not showing for me.
Is Amanda still on?
Yeah, I'm here.
Amanda, when I went to the multimedia latest video page, the one we told people about, the one on the top row, fourth one, that's actually not the one that's linked to the Charm Telecon.
Okay.
It's the radar shows evidence of seas, which is on the third
right.
row down on the latest video page.
Okay.
I had already sent out an announcement, at least to my Saturn Observation Campaign people, and then I figured I made a boo boo. So.
Okay. Thanks for pointing that out there.
Yeah. Okay,
I'm going to start the video in a few seconds.
Hang on, real quick, Carl. Is everybody caught up?
So anybody who has a web browser can go to the Cassini website, click on multimedia, and from there go to videos. And then the third row down, there's a whole bunch of videos. You know, in fact, a whole bunch of these are brand new. But the one that is linked to the Charm Telecon is called Radar Shows Evidence of Seas. There's a couple of other Titan ones. That's where I got confused. And one of them has that beautiful mosaic, the Titan North Polar Region. So, the page, the Charm Telecon page, is in the process of being updated. But Kirk, our webmaster, can't get hold of the Raytheon contractors who will actually make it happen. So he's trying to be on the phone with those people, making it updated. He had already noticed it was wrong, but couldn't get hold of the right person.
Okay, maybe we can go ahead and start now.
Okay.
When I say now, if everyone could start simultaneously right from the beginning, then I can hopefully give you the guided tour aspect of it. So 3, 2, 1, now. Okay, what you're seeing here is a rendering of the Cassini orbiter approaching Titan. The images that we used are from the optical instrument, so they're at much lower resolution. Dark around the equator that you're passing here are actually the sand dunes of Titan, as they're referred to. So these are solid materials. The Cassini orbiter does a flyby no less than about 1,000 kilometers altitude above the planet. So it gets fairly close, but not as close as a dedicated orbiter would do around the planet. So you're seeing the Cassini orbiter slowly panning, looking at the surface. Now we're going to start showing some of the radar images. Here you go. This is some of this lake region here. We're actually going across some of the sea-like features. So this is along the T25 swath. This is the entire panorama. And now we're going to start at the top left in this area of small irregular-sized lakes here. You'll notice there are depressions. Unfortunately, the illumination is slightly different for the different images. But you can make out some of the depressions. They're clearly liquid-filled, channels of various sorts, varying morphology. How dark the blue is gives some indication of how deep the lake is. There's various structures on here that you'll see that look like depressions that are not filled with the dark materials. So again, these are the like lakes. This is that big on the bottom left here. We're flying past the basin-like feature that we said may or may not be liquid. Various channels come into existence. I do hope everyone's on the same part of this as I am. Coming into, mostly it speaks for itself, to tell you the truth. I've gone over quite a lot of these before. Various islands in some of the lakes. Again, the morphology changes as you go across the scene, which suggests a large amount of geologic variability in the subsurface features. This is now going to take a right angle here and start going in a different direction. This is a fairly low latitude for the lake regions here. This is in the 70 to 75 degrees north range. And now we're going to swing up and head back towards about 80 degrees of a different one of the radar swaths. You're just about to start seeing the large river valley, which we haven't named yet, that leads to very fjord-like structures in 1C. Lovely crinkly river valleys and extended lakes that remind me a lot of Lake Powell. And now we're going to start panning out, zooming out, and looking at this massive area that we refer to as the Black Sea sometimes, very informally. Again, 100,000 square kilometers, so larger than any of the Canadian Great Lakes or North American Great Lakes. And there you have it. I hope that was possible for all of you to see, but if not, it's well worth downloading to look at later if you get the opportunity. And I think I'll stop there.
Carl, I have a quick clarifying question. When you say larger than the Great Lakes, you just mean literally square footage on each one. Relative to the size of Earth, those seas up at the top of Titan are really very large.
Oh, yeah.
Like the Hudson Bay or something.
The surface area of Titan is a lot less than the Earth, and I'm using absolute terms. Those largest seas, as we're calling them, are many times the largest Canadian Great Lakes. In fact, they're comparable with the inland seas of Asia, so the Black Sea, the Caspian Sea, maybe even slightly larger than those in terms of percentage surface coverage. Certainly a lot larger than Great Salt Lake and the Aral Sea and various other sea-like bodies on the Earth.
Okay, just wanted to clarify. Thanks.
Okay, open to questions if anyone wants to ask.
Yeah, hi, this is Ken from New Jersey. I have a question about the radar instrument itself, so I'm going to be giving a talk on about this. Can you tell me where on the spacecraft is this located?
It's the big
part of the antenna or below the antenna?
It's the largest antenna on the spacecraft. It's the big boom that's sticking out the side. If you look at the movie, the first time step of the movie, you'll see the spacecraft there, and it's one of those two big booms, one that's facing forward and one that's coming out to the side. I have to say that I'm not an expert on how the radar instrument works, partially because I'm a foreign national, which means I'm not allowed to know how the radar works. It's export controlled data.
Right. But the instrument itself was built in Italy, is that right?
It's an Italian, it's a collaboration between the Italian Space Agency and NASA.
Right.
It was constructed largely by the Italians. In collaboration with NASA.
Okay.
And maybe, Carl, I could add two things to that. The high-gain antenna, the giant white dish at the top, if you were actually looking at it with your eyes, you would see something, you know, in the center that looks like a little parabola, which is the different radar beams. And then if you could see through the high-gain antenna, there's a series of 12 or 13 electronic bays that have all the electronics and computers of the spacecraft, and the radar bay takes up one whole bay of those. So those little hexagon things that are right under the high-gain antenna, that's where all the electronics are, if that helps.
Under the high-gain, not within, inside it.
There is a piece inside it. It looks like a little, looks like a little U-shaped parabola. It's easily visible if you were standing sort of, looking at the spacecraft with your eye. The high-gain antenna is, 4 meters in diameter, and the parabola is probably about a foot.
Okay.
So it's easily visible, and it's got a little U, and it's a little broken up into little pieces, and it's easy to spot. And then all the electronics are beneath the high-gain antenna in one of the bays.
All right, thank you. You see, I'm actually giving a talk to an Italian club, and that's why this is kind of important.
Yeah, the Italians built the high-gain antenna, and they built several pieces of both the radar and the radio science experiments on board Cassini.
Now, did they design the radar? Because I think Charles Alacci is the principal investigator for the radar, is that right?
Yes, he is.
I'm curious, who designed the radar? Did he design it, and it was just built in Italy, or how did that work out?
This is actually from before I joined the team, and I have to say I'm not really privy to the design aspect of Cassini radar. Amanda probably knows more than I do.
I think it was designed here at JPL.
Mm-hmm.
It's what's called a facility instrument. So I think the design came from the group of experts here at JPL, of which Charles is part of that group. He's also the lab director here, and he's also the principal investigator for the Cassini radar instrument.
Yes.
So I think the design came from JPL, and it was mostly built here.
Okay. Okay. But with Italy also, right? Italy
well,
also.
The Italians built the high-gain antenna, so the high-gain antenna...
Oh, okay.
But it's a critical component of the
yeah, there you go.
The radar
committing the data, right. Okay. But the radar then was actually built at JPL. Ah, okay.
Boy, gosh. I'm pretty sure.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to say where one group ends and the other group begins sometimes.
Yeah, I've been trying to find this out. I've looked extensively through all the Cassini literature, and it's a little bit murky.
When it comes to how the radar works and how it's all designed, because of the fact that radar potentially has military applications, really often JPL there's so much paperwork to go through in order to get out that information that sometimes it's not done as clearly as it could be.
Okay. I get some science questions too now.
Okay.
The ethane composition, what is the methane-ethane ratio, roughly?
Unknown.
Very.
Unknown. Completely unknown. There are some models that suggest that quite a lot of the methane in the atmosphere would eventually become ethane, but there are few constraints. Originally, the Lenin et al. Papers that suggested there'd be oceans of liquid ethane based on various assumptions that clearly are not true. That suggested that most of the surface features would be predominantly ethane that were liquid. And so we're in a process of re-exploring that issue.
Okay. And the future radar passes now, you said there are not going to be many at the poles. I guess they will be just distributed throughout Titan, or are they going to be equatorial, or where will they be?
Over the next year or so, there's going to be two more south polar passes, I think. One more north polar pass. This is for the radar ones, because we share the observations with all these different instruments.
Right.
So it's a matter of deciding which instruments need the data most and trying to share between all of the different groups. There will be a lot around, obviously, at the lower latitudes. It's very much on a... The radar does tend to do fairly well out of the flybys, because whenever it's a nighttime observation, whenever you're mostly looking at the dark side, the radar does tend to get the observation. But we don't always get a lot of choice as to where you image, because you just fly by when you can. But yeah, predominantly close to the equator, because, well, there's obviously more land surface at lower latitude.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Amanda, I guess I had one thing for the gentleman who was asking about the radar instrument.
Yes.
Chris Russell put together a set of summary articles in Space Science Reviews.
Oh, he did.
And that's an excellent resource if you want to know the basics of any particular instrument.
Oh.
So take a look for that. It's Space Science Reviews.
All right.
And the editor was Chris Russell. And then look for the radar article.
And I was also, this is Jane, I was also going to suggest if you go to the Cassini website and go under the spacecraft orbiter instruments.
I did, right.
There's a whole page on the radar instrument. Now, the difference between the radar instrument and the antenna is where I think your Italian connection comes in. So I'm actually looking for for the spacecraft antenna page.
Yes, I looked there, and that's what I'm saying. It there's not a whole lot of detail there on who did what. On where everything is located.
It tells about the instrument.
Right.
It doesn't tell who did what.
Yes, exactly. It tells about the instrument.
We can't tell you that.
Okay. Oh, that's
no,
fine.
No, that was a joke.
Yeah, no, it might be an ITAR issue. No, I understand that could be an issue, and I was just curious.
Yeah, no, it's not an ITAR issue. It's in the Space Science Reviews, and in fact,
right.
I just found it. I'll just take 30 seconds here to tell you what it is.
Mm-hmm.
There are four subsystems for the radar instrument.
Right.
The one of them, the RFES, which is the radio frequency electronic subsystem, was built by the Italians.
The second one, quickly, Trina, built at the ESS. The energy storage subsystem was built at JPL. Mm-hmm. The high-gain antenna was built by the Italians. And that must mean there's one that I'm missing.
They built the low-gain antenna, too.
They also, who built the low-gain antenna? I believe that was built at JPL, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
And the DSS was built, the digital subsystem was built at JPL. So basically half and half for radar.
Okay.
Half from the Italians and half from JPL. And we all learned something today.
Thank you. No, that's really helpful.
The Cassini-Huygens mission is actually a very good example of the Americans and the Europeans working extremely well together. Obviously, the lander was predominantly European, whereas the orbiter was predominantly American.
Yeah. Is it possible to get your email in case I had any follow-up questions?
Sure.
My name's Ken Kramer, by the way. I'm a JPL ambassador.
Great. My email address is Carl, K-A-R-L, dot L.
Carl dot L.
Yes, dot Mitchell, M-I-T-C-H-E-L-L, at jpl.nasa.gov.
jpl.nasa. All right, I'll send you an email then.
And anybody who has regular questions anytime can always send them to the email address that's on every single announcement of these talks, to charm_leads, and we'll be happy to forward them in case everybody didn't write down Carl's email address. Yeah, we're happy to take the questions and pass them on.
Yeah, thank you. This is Trina.
No, this is Jane.
Jane, okay.
Any other questions or anything right now?
Cryovolcanism. I wanted to ask about that.
Oh,
did
yes.
you say there was no evidence? Did I hear that correctly?
We have lots of evidence of cryovolcanism. We've got surface features that look like cryovolcanic features. We have nothing that is convincing evidence for active cryovolcanism.
Okay.
And some of the features that we've interpreted as cryovolcanic may be open to different interpretations.
There was one about a year ago or so that I thought was pretty convincing at that time.
There's Ganesha Macula is possibly the one.
That one, right.
It looks like a massive dome. I was a co-author on that paper. I still think that is cryovolcanic, but it's certainly an unusual feature that can't be explained simply by direct analog with features on the Earth. So we're hoping for... we've actually got a second observation of that that hasn't been thoroughly released yet, and hopefully we're going to get stereo of that eventually so that we can construct a 3D terrain model, which will allow us to test many more ideas.
Okay, thank you.
Before everyone goes, if you're interested in looking at this further, I should point out the photojournal.jpl.nasa.gov website, which has all of the image releases that we've put together from the Cassini radar instrument, amongst with every other planetary instrument that's being run. It's well worth checking out because there's a lot on there, and they've all got detailed captions explaining our interpretations, at least at the time that we did the image release. That movie's on there as well.
Okay, any more questions?
Well, let me ask one more question. No one else has a question then. The large lakes are on one side of the moon. Is there any reason for that?
There is probably a reason for it. It doesn't look like it's just it looks like it's a real geologic thing. There does seem to be a very striking contrast between one hemisphere, let's call it, and the other hemisphere. The probable explanation is either due to topography or drainage or a combination of them both. The very lake-like areas, I would think that a good explanation, it may not be the explanation, is that they are higher and better drained than the sea areas. And so the liquids drain into those sea areas. And there's certainly a lot more area of these seas that we can see at the moment, at least, on one hemisphere than the other, which would kind of suggest that there's been liquid transport from one to the other.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
That's speculation, by the way.
Sure.
A lot of this is speculation. Yeah. We've got data that's limited to a few hundred meters resolution. There's only so much you can do. I mean, if you think back to the Viking orbiter days and Mariner days, their image resolution was actually slightly superior to what we're looking at now quite a lot of the time. So these are early days for Titan studies.
Do you have any kind of future mission? Would you, like, prefer a lander or a balloon mission?
I would be very happy for us to go to Titan in any capacity as
right.
a dedicated mission. As someone who deals mostly with remote sensing data, I'm more interested in the balloon mission because the balloon mission would allow us to get spectroscopy of a wide area of the surface. We could go from equator to pole, let's say, and see a lot of different human types. That is a purely personal prejudice, though. I know there's lots of people that have very good arguments for suggesting a lander mission. So a dedicated orbiter as well would get us wonderful data and would, of course, provide the uplink to the Earth. So almost any mission that's going to go back to Titan will probably have to have an orbiter and a lander or balloon or lander and balloon component. And it would probably involve the European as well because it's a large-scale mission.
This is Greg Cermak in Portland, Oregon. On one of the slides you had listed quite a few organic compounds, and I know there's been a lot of interest in these compounds called tholins, which are organic intermediates. Has any of your work touched upon that? I know it's a little outside of what you're doing in terms of the cycle, the weather cycles and stuff like that, but do they have any evidence of that through spectroscopy or anything else?
Tholins are a tricky one. There are lots of features that are consistent with tholins. As to whether you can tell 100% sure that they are tholins as opposed to other organics, I am not sure we've got very strong evidence for it on the surface. Certainly the models would support it. And the preferred theory for the sand dunes of Titan, these equatorial, dark, fine-grained materials that are quite mobile, are that they are what they call tholins. As to their role in the lake processes, I have very little idea. Again, we've got this huge range of different materials that we're having to look through the physical makeup of and how they interact with liquids in order to understand these lakes. We hope to be working on that very steadily and surely over the next few years.
Could you elaborate a little bit further on what you said with regard to the dunes at all?
Again, this isn't really my area. I think there was another dunes presentation a few months ago in these talks. Is that correct, Amanda?
Ralph did a dunes presentation, I think, back in March. Or maybe
yeah,
March.
That would be fairly up to date, and I think I'd prefer to refer you to that because, again, I don't really know all that much about the dunes.
I'm just curious.
Yeah.
Alrighty, thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Well, I'd like to thank everybody for calling in and participating, and thank especially our speaker, Carl Mitchell, for an excellent talk. And it was really interesting and informative.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, as a reminder for everybody, we will not be having a Charm Telecon next month in December, but we will have one at the end of January, the last Tuesday in January, and so stay tuned for an email on that topic. So thanks, everybody, and we'll talk to you in a couple of months then.
Great, thanks.
Thanks, Amanda. Bye. Thanks, Carl. It was great.
Bye.
Thank you. Thanks for organizing these. They're very nice.